Ward of the Veterans Affairs Division Committee. Please come to work.
I'd like to call on Representative Pugh to lead us in the flag, Pledge of Allegiance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, I'd like to welcome everybody. I know it's been a few days since we met last, and being that we didn't meet last week, but Representative Fisher, would you approve the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the approval.
Okay, thank you so much. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? First agenda items is that we, if I can find my right here. We House File 10 and the Veterans Job Tax Credit provided. And we have Representative Wills will be coming. Representative Wills, would you come for the committee and please introduce yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like me to go right into explaining the bill?
What I'm going to do now, I'm going to change the gavel here, and we can switch seats here. I'm going to let Vice Chair get some experience here, because I know I've got some bills coming up in the future, and he's going to be doing the same thing. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to the committee. And Representative Wills, if you would state your name for the record and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Anna Wills. I'm the state representative in Apple Valley, Rosemount, and Coates, and honored to bring before you the first bill for the Veterans Committee in the 2015 session, House File 10, which provides non-refundable tax credits to employers who hire veterans in the state of Minnesota. And just wanted to give a brief overview of the reasoning behind why I feel this bill is so important. And so just wanted to, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to present the bill. And wanted to give a little background on the unemployment rate in Minnesota. Our unemployment rate for veterans has been as high as 23% in Minnesota for our veterans, and that was as of 2011. And it's currently at 5% for all veterans and 8.8% for post-9/11 veterans in the state of Minnesota. And this is more than double the unemployment rate for civilian counterparts, which is about 3.7%. And as our service members come back to Minnesota from serving overseas, or even if they're just serving in another state, they're struggling to find jobs and reintegrating into civilian life here in Minnesota. And I personally have extended family members who serve in the military or have served, and so I have some personal background and personal support for the military. And then also as a state representative, the cities I represent, Apple Valley and Rosemount, are both Beyond the Yellow Ribbon cities. Very proud of that. And Rosemount is home to the 34th Infantry Red Bull Division, so very close to home for me. And as a progressive state, I believe that Minnesota needs to do a better job of taking care of our veterans. And we need to make Minnesota a veteran-friendly state for service members to come home and start civilian life by becoming Minnesota taxpayers in the private sector, rather than having them depend on state benefits or leaving to go to a more veteran-friendly state. House File 10, it has broad bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. Senator Chuck Wieger is carrying it in the Senate, and they're having their hearing on Wednesday. And so it's moving in both bodies, and I really believe it's a nonpartisan issue. I also have in your packets letters of support from former Secretary of State Mark Ritchie and also several businesses that have come out in support of this bill. And you'll also note that the dates on those letters are for 2013. I had introduced the exact same legislation 2 years ago, and so It's based off of the language that I had in 2013, which made its way through the committee process on the House side and was unfortunately stripped out in the conference committee with the Senate. So trying again this year, and honored to have the opportunity to present it before you. I also wanted to list a few different veterans groups that are in support of this legislation, and some of them are here today and are going to be testifying. We have the Military Action Group, the United Veterans Legislative Council, the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, and the Association of the United States Army. And I also have Dennis Davis here with me today to testify, and with your permission, Chair, I'd invite him to the testimony stand.
Please come down.
So, and Dennis Davis has worked with me on this legislation, and as a veteran, brings valuable experience to the process and will be speaking to the benefits.
Mr. Davis, welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Dennis Davis. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for hearing this important piece of legislation today. I'm a veteran of 16 years of military service, both in active duty Navy and the Air Force Reserve. I've deployed twice in support of Operations Iraqi and Enduring Freedom, once to the Doverport Mortuary, Dover Air Force Base, where in just under 90 days as a brand new second lieutenant I saw almost 300 casualties, and then again in 2010 to Kandahar, Afghanistan. Left my family as a reservist, 3 weeks notice, and off, gone for a 5-month deployment. So I understand a little bit about the employment piece, as I'll cover in a second, and leaving on short notice and what that does to an employer, because I've been on and off active orders no less than 4 times during that time as well, in addition to the deployments. In the private sector, I have done, I own my own company as a consulting firm, helping companies hire veterans, creating sustainable, replicatable veteran hiring initiatives. I'm an author, I'm a speaker, working on my second book on post-traumatic stress, and hopefully a documentary film as well. But in the private sector, I have seen hundreds of thousands of resumes, interviewed thousands of people, I've hired hundreds of people. So I understand the other side of the hiring desk, which is why partnering with Representative Wills on this important piece of legislation and why it's framed this way. It is framed very similar to what used to be called WOTC, Work Opportunity Tax Credits, at the federal level. So we use that as a model to write this piece of legislation. I understand by the employers I still deal with today, the questions that I get and the stereotypes, both positive and negative, that come up with hiring veterans. And this is aimed at providing an incentive financially to hire veterans for those employers to help eliminate or reduce, we will never eliminate, but to reduce the disproportionately high unemployment rate for veterans. So that's a little bit about my background. Why is this important? For me, it's important because I've seen those stereotypes in hiring veterans across the board. Whether it's they're broken, they serve, they're broken, they need to be fixed. Post-traumatic stress comes up in almost every conversation. I won't say almost. It comes up in every single conversation I have with a potential employer as a stereotype. They assume that you wore a uniform, you deployed in the last 15 years. Again, you must be broken, you must need to be fixed. They don't understand post-traumatic stress and how that complicates things. And so there's a resistance in hiring there. It's not overt, it's covert, because if it was overt, they'd be sued, and that would be really bad PR and bad optics. But these typically are simply not true of the people that have served our great country. What I want you to do right now, this is a little exercise, we're going to work together here. If you have a pen and paper, I want you to draw a 3-legged stool. I'm serious about this, please draw a 3-legged stool. Audience, you can participate too. And each of those legs, I want you to label one leg as employment or unemployment. The second leg is PTSD. And the third is suicide. So this is the 3-legged stool that is the veteran and that transition back into the workforce. And when one of those legs is weak or overburdened, that stool is not going to stand strong. So we have the unemployment issue. Representative Wills already gave the numbers on that. I don't think I need to elaborate any more. But post 9/11 veterans, 2.5 times the rate currently for unemployment. That's an issue. PTSD is either perceived or they actually have PTSD, but the employers don't. You cannot walk down the street and point at people and go, well, you have PTSD, you don't. I want to hire you, I don't want to hire you. So it's a mental health issue, but you're not broken, you don't need to be fixed, but you are forever challenged, and you need to understand how to live that new life. But employers don't get that. They don't understand that. This would help incentivize them to say, you know what, we need to be able to take a deeper look at these veterans. Then we work into the suicide leg of the stool. I am by no means saying that unemployment is causing veteran suicide. I don't believe in this causational relationship, but it is certainly correlated. And here's some numbers for you. So nationally, suicide rate for veterans currently is 22 veterans a day commit suicide. 22. That's over 8,000 a year. That's more than 1,200 that have lost their lives to suicide in the last year than all of Iraq and Afghanistan combat casualties combined. And two-thirds of those are 50 or older. So this isn't a problem that's going to go away anytime soon, because they have difficulty coming out and making that transition, and it affects them just as much in later life as it does in earlier life, which is one of the reasons we've addressed the bill, written the bill the way we have, so that it covers all veterans and not just post 9/11 veterans. In Minnesota, from 2005 to 2011, the latest statistics we could find, 27.7 per 100,000 veterans committed suicide a year. In 2011, the statistic was 31 per 100,000. The civilian population from 05 to 11 was 13.3. More than twice the civilian population, yet we're less than 7% of the population. So again, if you look at that stool that we drew earlier, there clearly is a correlation between the trauma that they potentially have seen or not, or it's perceived trauma that you must be broken, you must need to be fixed, we don't want to hire you, the lack of ability to get a job and provide for a family and make that clear transition into the civilian world again, and the suicide rate. We don't expect this bill to instantly cure the suicide rate or PTSD or even the unemployment rate for veterans, but we would hope in time with the right incentives that they would those would begin to lower. So the impact of this is not just about an employer getting a tax credit. This impacts real lives, real people, real families, and literally could save a life. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Are there any questions? Representative
Mr. Davis? Chair, and I think we need to officially move the bill. And I know, so I would move House Hall 10, that it's before the committee. So we need to officially do that.
Any other questions?
All in favor?
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? It passes.
Mr. Chair, I did have a few other testifiers that would like to say a few words, if it's okay.
That is fine. Please introduce.
We had Joe Johnson from Trust Vets, and then also Jerry Kaiser, and I forget which organization you're representing today. All of them.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Joe Johnson, and I am the founder of Trust Vets.
And you please still go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
You still have Bob's name tag in front of you. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for this opportunity today. I never served the military, but I have the great privilege of serving its veterans through our company, Trust Vets. Trust Vets has a simple mission, and that's uniting American military veterans for success in business. And with years of effort in building this company, I can tell you that this demographic of Americans is steeped in honesty, integrity, in pride. They have tremendous respect for getting the job done right and getting it done the right the first time. They understand the value and the importance of chain of command. We, as American taxpayers, have invested staggering amounts of money into training these individuals. We steep them in boot camp and the military experience, and they come out of it stronger, better Americans. They have raised their right hand and volunteered to personally sacrifice to make America a better place for all of us. Now, in my experience in dealing with veterans, there are some that come home and quietly want to step in the shadows. They are a very humble breed, and they do not want recognition for their service. They do not want special treatment, and they do not want to gain from having served our military. But for the most part, what I've found is most of them wish to continue serving our community as painters, as plumbers, as dentists and bankers, as lawyers, as employees of Minnesota companies to help make them stronger and to work together to see a better future for all of us. They're raising their families in a free country, a little bit of their own making, and it's incumbent upon us to empower them to that position so they can continue serving their community, so they can find that pride. The greatest challenge, I believe, facing veterans and civilians is the clutter in the veteran community. There's a great deal of white noise. On the veteran side, there's so many organizations, they don't know who is talking and who is doing. They don't know where the support is versus where the PR is. And for so many people in so many companies, they hear about the veteran suicide rate. They hear about PTSD. They hear about the flaws of our veterans when they come home. And we cannot trust employers and hiring directors to understand the value of veterans. It's not incumbent upon them to understand the great sacrifice or the immense amount of training they've received or what they bring to the table. So if we need to incentivize financially the employment of our veterans, I think it's the least we can do. I think it is important for all of us to lift up our veterans and put them in a position so they can continue serving our communities here at home, because it will be better for all of us in business, and it will provide better business for Minnesota. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions? Thank you for testimony, Representative Wills.
And then we had Jerry Kaiser as well. I believe that's all we have for testifying today. If there's anyone else, I'm not aware of it.
Welcome, Mr. Kaiser. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm the Vice Chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council, which supports this particular issue. I am a Vietnam disabled combat veteran. I was got out of service 45 years ago. I was a helicopter crew chief machine gunner and two tours in Vietnam from 1968 to 1970. And this bill is really needed. I also am the representative for the equity position, representative at the Veterans for the Vikings Stadium. And that is a situation that we're trying to hire veteran-owned businesses to be in contractors in that particular stadium. There's an equity program for women and minorities, and that's written into the bill that you guys signed a couple of years ago, but there was nothing for veterans. And so after the fact, we got a contract handshake from Mortenson Construction Company and Ryan Construction Company that we'd get more veteran-owned businesses in there. One of the things that this would do would encourage those organizations, those businesses, to hire more veterans, especially disabled veterans. Now it's a heavily contracted business that would be maybe for disabled veterans, maybe wouldn't be poignant, but they could be, all these businesses can use more veterans in there. Right now, in that particular situation with the stadium, we're less than 5% of the businesses and 1% of the workforce. I turned that around. We're 1% of the work of the veteran-owned businesses, 5% of the workforce. This would improve that situation, because those companies that do get contracts will then have an incentive to hire more veterans, either disabled, those have been underemployed, and it would be a positive reinforcement of the service that they've done for their country. And it's Representative Wells has done this last year, and we're hoping that gets done this year. and the fact that the state of Minnesota will now certify who is a veteran-owned business. And that, along with this, would even encourage more businesses to hire veterans, whether they're involved with the Viking Stadium or any other project around the state of Minnesota or just in general business situations. I appreciate the time you took to listen to me, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. Any questions from the representative? Representative Wells?
I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen to the proposal, and it must be a good bill, so there's no questions. I appreciate your indulgence with the additional testifiers even after the bill was passed, and look forward to watching this bill move through the process. And if anyone does think of questions after the fact, feel free to contact me. I'd be more than happy to talk to you. So thank you.
I think before we finally move the bill, we should, is there anyone in the audience that would like to give public testimony, either pro or con, for the bill? Yes, please come forward and state your name for the record, please.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Carney Meekins. I'm a Vietnam-era veteran. I work within the structure of the community at Central Lutheran Church with veterans as a whole. So when I heard this gentleman speak about the veteran in terms of the community, is it extremely important, not only just in terms of work, but also in terms of the spiritual process as well. So yes, we do need to support ourselves and each other. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Meekin.
Mr. Chair, you know, I've been checking through my notes, and the procedures that we should probably follow is that we have to refer the bill on to the next committee. So would you do that?
I think, yes, Representative Detmer, we actually move to pass the bill and refer it on to the
No, we don't pass. We don't pass bills in here.
Okay. We pass the recommendation.
We refer it to the next. Refer it to the next committee.
Okay.
See, which would be.
I just wanted to make one comment, Mr. Representative Detmer, beforehand. New to the committee, was a small businessman that ran an S chapter tire store for 23 years. Wanted to help vets in the community. Am a veteran. Looking at the proposal, certainly it provides, I think, a very nice incentive for small businesses like myself that I think will greatly benefit not only the business environment but also our ability to give the veteran the help that they really need. And so I strongly recommend this bill. So we need to just move the bill. Refer it to taxes.
Yep.
And we need to vote on that?
All in favor.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Bill passes. Or the is moved to taxes. Motion passes, moved to taxes.
Chairman, nothing passes.
Nothing passes, no. I'd like to thank Vice Chair for, we need to get more people involved in the committee process, and I know there's going to be other bills coming up where I'll be presenting, and you'll be taking over the gavel there, and I want to thank everybody being patient, people in the audience being patient. We're getting through this process, and we're learning also, so. Thank you, Vice Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you. We're now going to turn the committee back over to its chairman and lesson learned.
Well, welcome to the committee, and you know, this is the time we're going to be talking about our five veterans homes that we have. And originally, I invited the five administrators to come in, and I know that that's pretty hard to get away sometimes to come into the committee, but I know we got three well-informed people here that will inform us on our five veterans homes. So welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike McKelney, Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs.
And I'm Robin Gaustad, and I'm the Acting Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Healthcare for MDVA.
I'm John Powers. I'm the Finance Director for Veterans Affairs.
Well, welcome to our committee, and please go ahead, and if you would like us to wait with any questions, the committee to wait with any questions, we can do that, or if questions come up, it's up to you how you'd like to have us ask questions.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to introduce the first couple of slides, then we're going to turn it over to Ms. Gaustad, and then she'll turn it over further to talk a little bit about budget, and then come back to Robin, and then I'll finish up. So in that process, and there's a lot of information in these slides, so I would just defer to you, Mr. Chair, if there are questions as we're going through some of these slides, it might be better to ask them then.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
So, Mr. Chair, the agenda we brought to you today is we're going to talk a little bit about the mission, what we do, talk about the waiting list at the veterans' homes overall, give you a brief financial update as to where we are with spending right now, talk about the campus development at Minneapolis, on the Minneapolis campus, touch on the bed count because that's always an issue, again, talk about the applications, explain a little bit about the cost of care and what goes into that calculation, and then also where we stand with CMS certification so far. First, what I would like to do again, and this is redundant to what you saw with the programs and services, as an agency we have the same overall mission. We're dedicated to serving the 370,000 plus veterans in the state. we do this through our vision of fulfilling the needs of Minnesota veterans and their families by providing quality and proven innovative programs and services that maximize their quality of life. And the context for this briefing is that there are, in fact, five state veterans homes, and they too work with the USDVA, veteran service organizations, CVSOs, and 501c3s, as well as private organizations. Again, pretty much the same population that the homes deal with, but in a different purview. Again, 370,000 veterans. It was mentioned earlier, approximately 7% of the state's population are, in fact, veterans. They're in all 87 counties. And again, just looking at the post-9/11 veterans, we know there's about 66,000 Minnesotans that have served since 9/11. Again, kind of a quick overview of the population as to where those veterans fall within service eras, Vietnam era veterans being the highest of what we have in the total population, and about 8% are women and 92% are men. This is a little bit new to you, Mr. Chair. Again, we wanted to show a little bit about the population that's likely to be served, although Robin will get into that a little bit more. But about 21% of the state's veterans are 65-year-olds or older, and about 24% are 75-year-olds and older. And so if you compare the state veteran population with the overall general population, you can see that if comparing those 75-year-olds, we're just about a third of that population of those aging people, as well as 65-year-olds and older. That's where those numbers come in. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Gaustad.
Thanks, Mike. The Minnesota Veterans Homes, we have five state veterans homes at this time, and they're located in Minneapolis, Hastings, Silver Bay, Laverne, and Fergus Falls. For the most part, we provide medical care on a 24/7 basis. And we provide that through skilled nursing care facilities and through domiciliary board and lodge. Minneapolis has a 50-bed domiciliary, and Hastings has a 200-bed domiciliary. At all of those sites, we provide rehab services, rec therapy, work therapy, dementia programs, pastoral care, social services, so a pretty well-rounded program and service. And on the Minneapolis campus, we also provide adult daycare. Our goal for all of our veterans homes is that every day is Veterans Day at the Minnesota Veterans Homes. We take great pride in serving those who have served, and have a very dedicated staff of employees who also are very committed to that vision. The other service that we provide at Minneapolis, at least the service is located on the Minneapolis campus, is the central pharmacy. All of our homes, except Fergus Falls, who will come on board this summer, take advantage of our central pharmacy distribution and provision of pharmaceuticals for all of our homes. Again, Hastings has the domiciliary. We're licensed for 200 beds. We provide services to 160 to about 180 folks, and they have a strong vocational and work therapy program, as well as most of you know who have visited the Hastings site. We have a very extensive wood shop, and the veterans love working there. Our Greater Minnesota homes all provide skilled nursing facilities and nursing care. In terms of what we do and who we serve, in our skilled nursing facilities, our average age is about 80. We do serve a large number of World War II and Korean vets, and you can see the typical kinds of diagnoses that you would expect to see in a long-term care facility, including Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's. We also provide a lot of care for hypertension and diabetes. Our adult day center serves pretty much that same population, but as most of you know, adult daycare is a program that allows for some respite for families and some services for our veterans, our clients who come. They come on a daily basis, so they come in the morning, 7:30, 8 o'clock, and leave about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the evening, and we have room for 35 clients per day, and we are probably serving about half of that volume right now. So we do have room in our adult daycare program, and are always looking for further referrals. Our domiciliary programs, which again are at Hastings and then a 50-bed program at Minneapolis, serves primarily Vietnam vets. However, we have been seeing quite an increasing number of Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans as well. Approximately 70% of the folks that use that program have behavioral health or mental health and chemical dependency issues that they're dealing with. And so you can see that alcohol dependence and various psychiatric disorders are high on the list of folks we serve there. One of the common questions that we get, and I know something that you're all always interested in, is what are the waiting lists at our skilled nursing facilities? At Minneapolis, we're just over 700 folks on our waiting list. That waiting list can, you can be on that waiting list for 6 months up to a year. It's very hard to, of course, manage that from our perspective because we need an empty bed in order for a new resident or veteran to move in. And so that's not real predictable at times, but we tell families somewhere between 6 and 12 months, depending on how things shift on that list.
Mrs. Gossett?
Yes.
Could you explain how you get on a waiting list?
Sure. Thank you for that question, Chair Detmer. On the right now, in terms of a veteran in a family getting on that waiting list, folks fill out an application for admission. And folks are put on that waiting list by the date of their application. And so as folks move up that list and are 3 to 5 folks from the top, they'll get a call from our admissions staff letting them know that they've moved up on the list and asking to see if they still are looking for a nursing home bed or if they would like to go on our more inactive list. So in other words, they haven't made a decision to actually admit. Sometimes folks like to be put on the waiting list because obviously it takes a while to work oneself to the top, and they're trying to be proactive in terms of making sure that their loved one is on the list in the event that they need it. So some folks are on the list because they're ready for admission. Mm-hmm. and other folks are on the list because they're trying to be proactive in terms of then as they work their way up the list, if their loved one becomes ready for skilled nursing facility, 24/7 care, then they're on that list and working proactively.
And just to follow up, Ms. Gossett, would, when you put on the list, does it have to be for a certain home, or can you say, well, if there's an opening in another home, I would go? I know families would like to be together with their loved ones in as close as possible, but how does that work if a family says, well, whatever is open, can we take get on the list of another home?
Yes, thank you for that question, Chair Detmer. Yes, folks can put themselves on the waiting lists for all of our homes, Minneapolis, Fergus Falls, Silver Bay, or Laverne, or if they have a preference for just one home because that's really where they want to be, that home is closest to family and loved ones and friends, then they can put themselves on just one list. So they've got that option. They can either go on the list for all four skilled homes, or they can pick and choose any match there.
Okay, thank you. Continue.
So anyways, you see the number of the approximate number of folks on the waiting list for each of the homes. Laverne obviously is under 100. We have no waiting list at Hastings for the domiciliary there. So again, that program has capacity, and certainly we would look forward for admissions there. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Powers.
Go ahead, Mr. Powers.
Mr. Chair, members, the Veterans Healthcare Program budget for the biennium for 14-15 was $211.9 million for the biennium. $94 million of that was from the general fund appropriation. $97.4 million of it was received in revenue from VA per diem and resident maintenance charges. An additional $15.9 million will be received from the federal government to cover construction grants, mainly at Minneapolis. We did have some work done in Laverne and Fergus, which amounted to about $500,000. Over the biennium. $3.3 million of the budget is in resident trust and canteen accounts along with the wood shop. $0.9 million of it is in gift and donations, which for the homes we received over the biennium, almost $1 million. And then we have about $400,000 in special revenue accounts that we have. For FY14, we have FTEs of almost 1,100. If we look at the expenditures by fund, there is one missing on this graph, and that would be the last one at 1.6%, and that's actually the resident trust accounts. But if we look at this, 44.4% of the expenditures came out of the general fund. 45.9% came out of the special revenue, and again, that was the per diem and resident maintenance charges. 0.4 out of miscellaneous special revenue, 7.5 out of federal grants, and again, 1.6 was the resident trust. For the 14-15 biennium, if we look at the other program again that we talked about 2 weeks ago, was the programs and services. For the 14-15 biennium, programs and services makes up about 18%, whereas the healthcare program makes up 82%. General fund alone, it's 87% healthcare and 13% programs and services. If we look to the right there, expenditures by category, we spent about 70.9% on payroll, 20.2% on operating expenses, 1.5 on grants and aids, and capital outlays of 7.4%. This next slide, I want to point out that 2 weeks ago when we presented for programs and services, I made a change to this particular slide, if you will, and it's to show the actual distribution between general fund and miscellaneous special revenue fund. For programs and services, I had showed the miscellaneous special program revenue actually higher, which included the general fund money. In this particular slide, I separated it out to give you maybe a better accurate depiction of that. So if you happen to go back and say, why don't these match, that's the reason. So overall, if we look at column A, for the department, we have a $258 million biennial budget. For the general fund, which is $126 million, which was 48.9% of the general fund, or of the total budget. Special revenue, $2.3 million, was 0.9% of the total budget. Miscellaneous, again, special revenue, which is your per diem and resident maintenance charges, was $97 million, which is 37.7%. The other big one there is the federal funds. $28 million of federal funds, construction funds, were taken in during the biennium, which made up about 10.9%. If you go over to column C, you can see that for health care, $93.9 million was from general fund money, which is 44.3% of the health care budget. If you look at miscellaneous special revenue, $97 million, which makes up about 45.9%. And again, the other big one is the $15 million, almost $16 million for federal funds during the biennium, which made up about 7.5% of the program budget and 6.2%. Overall, the federal health care makes up about 82.1% of MDVA's budget.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Lish?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having a tough time understanding this, and I see by based on expenditures, but it looks like we're talking about revenues. How much? I presume that more than 10.9%. Of revenues are federal to pay for Veterans Affairs Services in Minnesota. Am I correct? Or is that on another slide that I'm just not seeing?
Mr. Powers?
Maybe I can clarify, Mr. Chair. You've got for expenditures by fund, 10.9% of it is from federal. Am I right about that?
Mr. Chair, Powers. Representative Lesh? Yeah, the $28 million, which is 10.9%, are just the construction grants for the homes and the cemeteries.
Okay, so Mr. Chair,
Mr. Lesh,
if you can just give me an idea, not a specific number, but a broad idea. How much of the revenue that you take in is from the federal government, and how much of it is from the state, and how much of it is other sources, just general?
Mr. Powers?
On the healthcare side, if we just separated the per diem alone, which is basically from the federal government, that represented about 62.7% of this budget. I take that back. I don't have the exact, Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the exact number on that. It's confusing with the, if we factor in the construction dollars, but Mr. Chair, Mr. Lash, I'd be happy to get that to you.
That'd be great, Mr. Chair, if I could just... I know it's confusing because we're talking about health care and other stuff, too. So if we could just connect up offline on that, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question, too, if I could, and I don't know who's best at the table to answer this, is I heard several times referred to resident maintenance charges and wondering what that is, how is it paid, and what does it cover, and how does that flow?
Mr. Powers or Ms. Gostad?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Chair Detmer, Representative. Actually, I have a couple of slides on VA per diem, full cost of care, maintenance charge, and what have you. If I could come back to that question, I think it'll roll right through the presentation. I was thinking that might be something you'd be interested in.
Representative Fisher, anything else?
Oh, that's it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Continue.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, this final slide shows the breakdown for each of the different divisions, if you will, for veterans health care. Our administration and pharmacy has a $10.7 million budget, which is 5.1% of the total program budget. and 4.1%, and we have 30 FTEs that work in that area. For the Minneapolis Veterans Home, it's $98 million budget, 46.3% of the program budget, and 38% of the total department budget. And we have 572 FTEs in Minneapolis. The Minneapolis building expansion, which is primarily phase two, is almost $16 million for the biennium that we would have taken in, which is 7.5% of the program budget or 6.2% of the department budget. Hastings is $19.6 million. It's 9.3% of the program budget and 7.6%, and we have about 100 FTEs there. Silver Bay, $22 million, 10.5% of the program budget, 8.6% of the department budget, and we have about 131 FTEs there. Laverne, we have almost a $20 million budget, which is 9.5% of the program budget and 7.7% of the department budget, and about 115 FTEs there. Fergus Falls is a $25 million budget, 12% of the program budget, 9.8% of the department budget, and we have about 151 FTEs there. Again, overall, we have about a $212 million biennial budget for veterans health care, which is 82.1% of the department's budget, and about 1,100 FTEs that work there.
Yeah, Mr. Powers, looking at when the phase two is completed, how many FTEs are you going to be looking at to staff that facility, or is it just part of the FTEs that you already have?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it would be part of the FTEs we currently have.
Okay. Representative Look.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious on the administration and pharmacy line. For the purchase of pharmaceuticals, does the state have flexibility to purchase them in a different manner than at least what we hear is a big issue with the federal government, where they're kind of locked into a one price fits all, and there isn't a high degree of competitive bidding? Is there? Do we enjoy any ability to deal with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think I can take that question. The Central Pharmacy actually reports through my office in Veterans Healthcare, and we have two methods that we can utilize in terms of purchasing pharmaceuticals. And one is through the federal VA contract, and pharmaceuticals that we purchase through the VA contract, we get very excellent pricing on. And state contracts and or local contracts with pharmacies in some of the greater Minnesota areas where we need sometimes an emergency medication access after hours doesn't come anywhere close. So we try to use the federal VA formulary. However, if a veteran or resident requires medication that's not on that formulary, we utilize the same state pharmacy contracts that other agencies like DOC and Department of Human Services uses in terms of the Department of Admin and through those statewide contracts. And we get good pricing there, but nothing close to the federal VA formulary. We have no difficulty getting medications through the VA at all.
Captain Luke?
Thank you. That answers the question.
Okay, thank you. Yes. Please continue.
The next slide is actually one that you'll note if you visit the Minneapolis campus is ever-changing. I just wanted to point out a couple of the buildings that really house most of our veterans and residents. Building 19, all the way to my left, is actually the new building that we opened in 2012 and houses 100 veterans and residents, and is absolutely adored by all of our veterans and their families. So a very nice building on that campus. Building 6 is the oldest building on our campus, approximately 125 years old, and it houses 91 veterans currently. And those veterans are actually very anxious to see the new building, the front half of Building 17, If you've been on the Minneapolis campus recently, you know that that long rectangular building called 17, we've actually cut that in half, demolished the front half of that, that building called 17 North, and we are in the process of building a replacement 100-bed facility that is fully funded by both federal and state matching grant dollars. The backside of that building in 2016 will be demolished as the new building opens on the front side, and that building will also be a replacement building of 100 beds. The other two buildings that are occupied by clients or residents is building 16, way down on the other end of the campus, and that's where our 50-bed domiciliary program resides. And then building 4, which is kind of down towards that end of the campus as well, is where our adult daycare is housed. So just to kind of give you a little bit of orientation there. I wanted to show you then kind of pictures, if you will, of the new buildings that will replace building 17. The first page here is that north side of building 17. And as many of you know, when we build replacement buildings as the state of Minnesota, we have a numbering system, so that building will now become building quotes 21. And construction started February of 2014, and construction completion is scheduled for February of 2016. We will be developing admission criteria for that building, and all of our residents who are interested in moving into that building will be assessed against those admission criteria, and decisions will be made around who best fits those admission criteria.
Okay, excuse me, Representative Fisher.
I'm sorry, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if I could back up a second to the when you're going over the campus overview.
Yeah.
One of the things I had questions on is, knowing the campus is real close to the light rail connections, which provides mobility for folks who don't have cars to get back and forth, where does the connections for that, where they can get over the stations, line up on this map? I see a bridge down by 18. Is that where they come from? How do they connect with that transportation issue in there?
Thank you for that question.
Boston.
Yep. Chair and representative, right now that bridge that you see that kind of is off to the side of what's labeled Building 18, that is a bridge onto the campus, and if you go through the parkway, you can get to the light rail. That bridge is closed right now for assessment, structural assessment. And the Department of Administration is supporting MDVA in an analysis of that bridge for any kind of structural repair or replacement. And we're actually expecting that report will be due any literally day now.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. So going back to my question, how do they get over to the mass transit component there?
Gosted.
Thank you, Representative and Mr. Chair. The only way in and out of the campus right now is at 46th Street and 46th Avenue South. So if you're on Hiawatha, you take a turn onto 46th Avenue and go down to 46th Street and come across the bridge through the parkway.
So how much of an additional walk is that for folks who are from the campus, depending where they're located on the campus? It seems that ends up being a little bit of a distance.
Representative Chair Detmer, a couple of things. I couldn't answer that specifically because I haven't really taken the mileage, but I would assume that it's fairly equal, maybe a little bit longer. But we do have bus service, Minneapolis bus service, that comes right to the campus and makes a couple of stops throughout the campus. So staff can take buses as well if you're wondering about staff.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that connect with the light rail then as it drops them off? Because I know light rail kind of goes in a different direction. The buses kind of go back and forth, and the light rail goes up to it. So does that feed into some point at the light rail somewhere?
Ms. Gostad.
Representative and Chair Detmer, I don't travel the light rail or the bus system, but I think that what I can say is that just from observing, because I travel through there quite frequently, that there are multiple buses that come into that light rail location. There's also multiple buses that travel down 46th Avenue, and there's a bus stop right at 46th Avenue and 46th Street, and then there's two or three bus stops within the campus itself, both at the front end by Building 19 and on the other side of the campus near Building 16.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess part of this is I've run into a couple of folks who've come from the campus down there who try to get around, and with the bridge being down, it's caused some additional issues for trying to get around because their mobility is not as great as your average person, and they don't have other ways to get around. And for them, this has been a real hardship not having the bridge here. So I'm very concerned about that, particularly for those that are trying to get out, trying to get jobs, etc. And while there's a study being done, I think this is kind of an urgent thing. It sounds like the needs are not being well met. And so it's something that I'm not feeling a lot of comfort in the answers that I'm hearing here that this issue is really being addressed well.
Representative Fisher, who's really in charge of the bridge? Is it the Department of Transportation? I know it's a very narrow bridge to be in fact. Who's in charge of the bridge? Ms. Gosted?
Chair Detmer and Representative, we feel your pain, and our residents, our families, our visitors, and our employees all feel that pain. And what I can say is that the Department of Transportation issued us a notice closing the bridge. So it wasn't something that Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs initiated. The bridges, according to state policy and what have you, have to have a routine and regular inspection. When an early assessment of that bridge was done earlier in the summer, it was deemed to be unsafe for both pedestrian and vehicular traffic. And therefore, we were compelled with the Department of Administration to close the bridge. And so the reason that the bridge is closed is that both pedestrian traffic as well as vehicular traffic is prohibited because of the structural integrity of the bridge itself and questions about that integrity. And so the safest and most prudent thing to do was to abide by that order and close the bridge. Subsequently, we also were compelled to close pedestrian traffic underneath the bridge, so folks utilizing the parkway, because it was deemed that the bridge there was concern about the bridge from that regard as well as being unsafe, even underneath the bridge on the parkway down below. So we absolutely feel your pain. We had to go through, obviously, the state RFP process to choose vendors to come and do the bridge assessment. We've moved along and partnered quite well with the Department of Admin, who's worked very hard and diligently with us. I think we've done all the prudent things that we should do to ensure public safety, not just for folks who use our campus, but for folks in the community as well. And as I say, that assessment will be completed shortly. I would expect to see a report in February, and then we'll have to work with the Department of Admin and do some cost analysis of what our options are with the bridge, given the findings of the report. So you will likely be hearing more about the bridge.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I'm understanding then is the bridge is not owned by Minnesota Department of Transportation. This is a bridge that is under the control of the Veterans Association. Then?
Yes, Representative Chair.
Yes.
MDVA inherited the bridge, and so we do own everything from the where the bridge adjoins the parkway all the way onto the campus. Obviously, our core mission is to care for our veterans. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and we're not interested in being bridge owners. And so we would work diligently, and I know that some of our commissioners are looking at that question as well and what makes the most sense. But right now, we do, Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs is responsible for and owns that bridge, and so we take our guidance from Department of Transportation, the Parkway Board, the City of Minneapolis, as well as obviously the Department of Administration.
Governor Fisher.
That's enough for now. I could spend more time on that, but I'm just concerned about the, you know, that's a key connection through there that
right.
seems to be down, and I understand challenges, but it doesn't seem like we have enough information knowing how that's going to be addressed going forward, and that's, you know, with where that's located and how the light rail lines up, it's a great spot and a bit of pain, and I guess my concern is that we don't lose the focus on that, because I understand you're not bridge owners, but it's providing a great service for the folks to get back and forth there.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Fisher, that's correct. And this is the first time I understood that that MDVA owned that bridge. And maybe we should be looking at it, maybe turning that bridge over to Department of Transportation. I don't know. But that's something that might want to consider. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anticipating what I was going to ask, I guess, did I miss it? Do you know yet what the cost of repairing that bridge is?
Ms. Gosta?
Chair Detmer and our representative, no, we do not. We don't have the completed assessment back from the crew that actually had to come in from out of state to do the structural review and analysis. We expect that report back in February, and as soon as we get that report, then I know that the Department of Admin, who has been a very good partner with us on this, will help us get those cost estimates, and we'll look at the alternatives and the recommendations by the experts who do this for a living.
And
Representative Purcell.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And do you anticipate that this then would become part of your request for this next budget cycle that we're in?
Ms. Gosted?
Chair Detmer, Representative, it's likely. I guess we'll have to see what the recommendations come back as, and what all of that information looks like. But at some point, you will be hearing from us and probably admin, Department of Administration, about what it's going to take and where we go from here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would request that we get this information as soon as they have it so we can try and be helpful.
Thank you, Purcell. And
thank you, Representative. I actually appreciate the support. The agency is very.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who might be able to answer this question, or if maybe it's just a comment, but given that this is a pedestrian trail, is that a pedestrian path? Wondering if the refurbishment of this might fall under the Parks and Trails Fund or possibly cultural heritage, if there's some significance that we could tap into those resources?
Well, I guess I could maybe address that. That would have to, you know, everybody's asking that committee, and I guess it would have to come and present it. It's a very historic facility that we have there, and I don't know how old that bridge is, but probably about as old as the Minneapolis Veterans Home itself. So that is a possibility.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see Mr. Kerr here, and I thought maybe the Corps of Engineers would want to throw up a Bailey Bridge and go across for the time being.
Okay, let's continue.
Okay, thank you very much. So the new building 21 is pictured there, and again, it'll open in February of 2016, and it is a 100-bed replacement facility for Building 17 North. I'm very pleased to say that with hard work from staff and support from the federal government, we were successful in getting the funding, the federal 65% match for Building 17 South, which will become Building 22 as it is constructed. We would hope to have that building open sometime the spring of 2016, probably even more like late 16. And with that facility, one of the things that we will accomplish is actually not just the replacement of existing beds, but it will actually provide us with 9 new beds, so some added capacity on the Minneapolis campus. So we are replacing 291 beds with 300 replacement beds, and so we will add an additional 9 beds to the Minneapolis campus as part of that plan.
Ms. Gostad, maybe it'd be good to share exactly, you know, the state does not determine how many beds we're going to have. What is the federal, I know the federal VA puts a limited number of beds that we are allowed to have. Do you know what that number is?
Yes, Representative and Chair Detmer. If we skip over this slide and we go to the next slide, I can answer that question for you. I thought that this group might be interested in looking at a current bed count in terms of where we are with bed capacity. And so right now we have in the state of Minnesota, under the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs, Veterans Healthcare, 814 beds. This number is a little bit different than the number in your slide, and I apologize for that. But I gave a presentation this weekend at the VFW conference, and as I was preparing for that, I noticed that there was a one bed count error. So I do actually have copies of this new slide, and it's slightly different, like by 1 or 2 beds, than the slide that's in your packet, and I very much apologize for that. I'm glad I had the dry run with our friends from the VFW this weekend so that I could clean up my act. So the current bed capacity at our state veterans homes right now in the state of Minnesota is 814. The VA, the federal VA, does an assessment of need on a semi-regular basis, and for the last several years, our current federal VA licensed bed capacity that is defined by the federal VA is 1,058. So that means that the Minnesota potential bed capacity for new beds is 244. But you'll note that I have some additional notes on the bottom of this page, and the reason I do is because after phase 3, so after we completely build out Building 17 South in 2016, their Building 6, which now houses 91 veterans, will be vacant. And yet is currently serving and providing health care for 91 veterans. And we remodeled that facility when we built Building 19, and we did it on purpose, one, so that it would be more inviting for families and residents, but knowing that long-term, we might want to use those 91 vacant beds after the construction of Phase 3 for some other kind of health care, whether it's skilled care or domiciliary care. So in total, the 91 beds from Building 6 plus the 9 new beds that I mentioned from Phase 3 will give the Minneapolis campus an additional capacity of 100 beds with no further new construction. And therefore, the potential bed capacity for new beds after the completion of Phase 3 at Minneapolis for the state of Minnesota would be 144 beds. Now I'll pause. I know that feels maybe a little confusing.
Well, I, Mrs. Gossett, I've been making the changes on my slide, so, you know.
I've got copies, sir, if you want them.
I could probably leave them with one of our pages, and the pages could hand them out. So what I understand is after Phase 3 is completed, we'll have also a capacity of another 144 beds that we could build.
Yes.
Okay.
In Greater Minnesota, sir. And we'll have an additional 100 beds that are built and ready for occupancy on the Minneapolis campus should we choose to use Building 6 and the 91 beds there.
Okay. Question, Newton.
Mr. Chair, yes, and Ms. Gostad, should we do that, how would that affect our FTEs?
Chair Detmer, Representative Newton. The caveat would be obviously that if we wanted to operate the 91 beds in Building 6, we would need additional appropriation for staffing and supplies and equipment. So that would be the caveat. We would need operating funds to operate those 91 beds.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Continue on.
The next couple of slides on pages or on 16 and I'm losing my place here. If you jump to the third page of that handout, I actually put this list of projects in your packet because I thought that it was important to pause and to appreciate the value that the federal VA grant program has provided to the state of Minnesota. So over the course of the last 5 or so years, the federal VA grant program for construction of both veterans homes as well as remodeling of some of our projects, the federal government in their 65% match has provided $110,582,000 to the state of Minnesota. And with that, not only did we improve the health care of veterans, but it also provided construction and other jobs for folks who worked with us on completing those projects. During that same time frame, the state 35% match would have been approximately $38,700,000. So for the state to provide the 35% match for this list of projects, the state provided monies of $38,704,000. At the same time, the feds, with their 65% match, gave us almost $111 million to improve the health care of our veterans and those we serve. So I just wanted to mention that because I know that folks are always interested to know what is the value that the federal VA provides for us, and I think that that has certainly been a value, and also we've benefited from that as the state of Minnesota. The next slide I'm not going to go into in detail, but I put it there because I think one of the other questions that we routinely get is how much a square foot does it cost, per foot does it cost to build a state veterans home. And so we had our construction manager, J.E. Dunn, do a comparison of buildings, building 22 for us. But the bottom line of this slide is when we built building 19 and opened it in 2012, that building cost us $260 a square foot. We are in the process of building building 21, which is 17 North, and the building for the 100-bed replacement facility itself is costing us $284 a square foot and will open in 2015. So that's today's dollars. Building 22, which will become, which is the current 17 South 100-bed facility that's still standing there, that will open in 2016, is estimated right now at 65% drawing completion to be $277 a square foot. So B19 in 2012, we built a building for $260 a square foot. In 2014 to 15, we are building a building at $284 a square foot. And to demonstrate the fiduciary responsibility on behalf of the staff at Veterans Healthcare at MDVA, in 2016, we will open B22, a new 100-bed facility, at $277 a square foot. So we've, I think, been working very hard to manage that cost. Part of the controversy, as many of you know, is that when we requested the dollars for B22, the dollars seemed exorbitant. And the reason and the purpose for this slide is to demonstrate the difference between what the bed facility itself at $277 a square foot costs compared to what it costs as we add all the campus infrastructure, the tunnels, the sewer, the steam, IT and communication links and what have you, that then drove that project to $355 a square foot. And so we just thought that it was important for folks to understand that we have been working very hard to be very respectful and to be very appropriate in terms of our spending and our management with the Department of Admin of our projects, and just wanted to just briefly share that with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And it was I think it was good to have this slide to keep everybody in tune of how you're managing and what you're trying to do for the veterans. So
thank you. And then I'll quickly close with some slides on cost of care, which I think, Representative, you were asking about. Mm-hmm. So what are the finances of a veterans home? There are three and actually four now with Medicare and Medicaid certification ways that we are able to supplement revenues at a veterans home. The VA, federal VA per diem, the resident maintenance charges, which you were asking about, which is that out-of-pocket sliding scale for folks who need that additional monies, and then the state general fund appropriation. So the VA per diem, the federal VA per diem, is that approved daily rate that is established by the VA to pay state veterans homes for providing care to eligible veterans. And then the question would be, well, who's an eligible veteran? And there are two sets of eligible veterans. There's the 70% folks who are 70% or more service-connected disabled. And that rate that's paid to or reimbursed to state veterans homes varies. But the prevailing rate today is, for instance, at the Minneapolis campus, $432.07 per day for a 70% or more disabled veteran. So we get that level of payment for a 70% service-connected veteran. Then we get what we kind of refer to as a regular per diem rate. That's the rate that's reimbursed to our homes for providing care to eligible veterans that are less than 70% service connected. So 69% to 0%. And that rate, for instance, right now at Minneapolis is $102.38. So you can see the difference between the full per diem prevailing rate at $432 at Minneapolis as we sit here today, and the, quotes, regular per diem rate for folks that are 69% to 0% service-connected disabled at $102 a day, and that's at Minneapolis.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask, that's for
the nursing home, is it also for the domiciliary? Do those rates apply at the domiciliary as well?
Ms. Gosted.
Chair Detmer, representative, the DOMS rate right now is $43.72, so quite a bit less.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Ms. Gosted. Mr. Chair, what if someone in the domiciliary is rated at 70% or more? Does that rate stay constant?
Ms. Gosted.
Representative Detmer, Representative Newton, we do receive also, and I don't have it at my fingertips, but we also receive a 70% rate for domiciliary that varies from the regular per diem rate.
Thank you.
And we can get you those numbers if you'd like them.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Okay, we're getting close to ending our time here. So,
excuse me.
Representative Fisher. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the rate is the $43.72 a day. That's what is provided coming in. And then how does the residence maintenance charge work in relation with that?
Ms. Gosted.
Chair Detmer, representative, the next slide talks about the maintenance charge. The maintenance charge is determined according to an individual's ability to pay. So folks who are receiving some portion of a regular per diem or not are then looked at in terms of their ability to pay. We do a financial analysis based on individual assets, income, and expenses. Those formulas are all defined in statute, and we follow them quite closely. Right now, we have about 83% of our residents, for instance, at Minneapolis, who pay some level of maintenance charge. And it can be all the way up to the full cost of care, all the way down to very little. It's very dependent on the individual's income and assets and expenses.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know it varies a little bit. I guess one of the questions that comes to my mind to get a better understanding of it is there are different programs out there, and I'm trying to figure out how this fits in, where if somebody has a dollar's worth of income, they automatically have to contribute that full dollar in. Some have it where it's sliding fee for every $2 you make, $1 goes in, you get to keep a dollar. There's others that say you keep the first $95 a month, and then after that, everything else goes to pay for the rates. How does that set up in for the DOMS rates and in terms of the maintenance charge?
Ms. Gosted.
Representative Detmer, representative. I think the easiest way for me to answer that is to send all of you the calculation that we use to calculate both the cost of care as well as the individual maintenance charge, because it is fairly complex. I think it might be good to start with my sending you that information, and then I would be certainly happy to come back and chat with you about it and or answer any questions you might have individually. But we have a very extensive, and I did bring it today, a very extensive flow chart on how that work is done. And so you can see that would probably be a fairly long discussion, and I'm not sure that it would be.
Well, Representative Fisher, I think what we could do, you could get it to the committee here, and we could get it out to the members, and then at our next meeting, if we had questions, we could present those questions at that time.
Representative Fisher. Chair, I would appreciate that.
Okay,
thank you.
And we know that that these per diems are set up by the federal VA, mm-hmm. And when was the last time Ms. Gosted, is when that the per diem has been increased?
Chair Dettmer, actually, it would not be unusual for that to occur or be assessed by the federal VA on an annual basis. So annually, we determine our cost of care, but at the same time, they're reviewing the cost of care for delivery by homes across the nation and then establish or reestablish those rates.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, continue.
The very last thing that I was going to mention, because I know that folks are always interested in where the veterans' homes are with Medicare and Medicaid certification and our process to have that happen at the homes so that we can make so we can take advantage of the of that funding mechanism as well. B-19, the replacement 100-bed facility, was certified by CMS last year. And in about mid-year, we began billing CMS, both Medicare, Medicaid, and actually private insurance, and have had some success in getting claims paid, and our staff will request initial CMS certification surveys for each of our new 100-bed facilities as they open on the Minneapolis campus. So we are moving ahead aggressively there. So we are right now billing Part A, Part B, Part D in terms of Medicare. We are billing Medicaid, and we are billing third-party payer insurances for that B-19 on the Minneapolis campus. The Silver Bay home is in the process of becoming ready for their initial certification survey, and we will request that survey to occur May of 2015. The Veterans Home in Laverne kicked off their team, and they will be applying for initial certification in January of 2016, and Fergus Falls will follow right after that. So by early 2016, it's my personal goal for our Veterans Homes that all of them will be in the skilled nursing facilities certified to be able to bill all facets of Medicare, Medicaid, and third-party payer insurances.
Okay. Okay. And I guess we're ready to wrap up here with Mr. McEnany.
Yes, so, Mr. Chair, yeah, in closing, just again, much like the programs and services side, just a reminder that MDVA is a part of the what we call the veteran enterprise here in the state of Minnesota. And a lot of the services that we provide both in the state veterans homes but also throughout programs and services helps bring back the, this funding to the state from the federal VA. The numbers you see here again, $2.3 billion just in VA benefits of various types have come back to the state. That's up $358 million since 2012. Again, we consider ourselves a continuously evolving post-war agency. This is our busy season, not just because we're starting our 14th year of conflict. We still have troops abroad, as you well know, but also a lot of our veterans are getting into that 65 plus age whereby they're going to need some long-term services. So we just like to highlight that and ensure that you're aware of that, which I know you are. And again, for us post 9/11 veterans, in my era, we're going to be with you for another 50 years, so we'll have a mission for quite some time. And beyond that, Mr. Chair, that concludes our briefing.
Are there any other questions? Anything from the audience? Again, I want to appreciate you coming in and sharing with us a little history and also some concerns that we have, you know, the bridge concerns and keep us posted on that information. And the department does an outstanding job keeping us educated in what's going on with the process with our not only just our five veterans homes but all the things that the Department of Veterans Affairs does for our veterans. And we know that this is you can really tell the character of a state or a nation, as I mentioned before, is how we take care of our veterans. So thank you again for sharing with us. And if there's nothing else, our next meeting is going to be February 2nd, Monday, February 2nd. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.